All right, ladies and gentlemen, after show time. Woohoo. So, all you lovely listeners, if you want to call into our Skype account and just hang out with the cast, you can Skype to Skype user decline to state. That's one word, decline to state. And we're just going to kind of hang around here and talk about some stuff on the show and whatever comes to mind. So we're on.
Yeah, that was fun. I've been looking forward to that one for a while. As she was mentioning at the end, I mean, having a new language to talk about things is, it's very intriguing. And I think if you were, you know, after meeting with Anne or listening to the podcast or even going yourself to one of the centers, it kind of puts a new lens to view things on. And you kind of want to start being like, I wonder if this person's got high graphoria or low, or maybe that's why their confidence
is low. I really was like kind of laughing in the background when she was describing me without knowing me. I thought it was really funny. I mean, kudos to you for being, you know, spot on with the assessment.
I mean, just a suspicion, but it seems to make sense, right? I think Eternal and I kind of offline and on, I think mostly offline behind the scenes, not even on the show. I've told him about this and I thought it was interesting. I was like, this seems like you are very much of this nature. And then, you know, it's been a long time coming to actually have an emissary from the organization come talk to us. And the fact that she was describing like a systems engineer, both of us were just like, we must have just been giddy while she was talking, even though we're in different parts of the country.
Yeah, I'm still giddy. I wish she could have stuck around for another hour. That's why I was kind of disappointed when she said, no, I gotta go walk. I love dogs though, but definitely, you know, an hour is not enough time with that woman.
It's not
enough time for this topic. So
fascinating
stuff. The
people from the San Francisco office were some of them were out on like, you know, maternity leave, you know, babies happening, or doing school, but they were all very nice and very receptive. You know, also lovely ladies too. So you know, build up follow-up questions, even listeners too, post to I think we'll probably post a link to the Johnson O'Connor Research Foundation site on the Decline to State subreddit. And discussion welcome. But I'm really, really glad to kind of share the interest.
Thank them so much for thank her so much for taking the hour to talk with us and everything, and
we'll
let her know that we really appreciated her coming on.
Yeah. I really like the fact that she showed kind of these broader concepts that people think of, like introversion and extroversion, have these subcategories to them, because that's something that's always struck me when I'm taking, for example, the Briggs-Myers. Anyway, and so I'm like, yeah, well, it depends on this sort of situation. Where am I? What am I doing? You know?
I wish I had more time to ask. I brought it up like towards the end there, the Jungian archetypes. I wonder how much that plays into, like, whether there's a lot of correlation or overlap there, or it's kind of a totally different thing with regards to, you know, what they test for versus, you know, what Jung kind of laid out, and like, I guess, like the David Kiersey's temperaments and all that stuff.
I mean, it's interesting because she's definitely, they're using a lot of their, I guess you could say, psychoanalytical type techniques, but it sounds like they've got more hard cutoffs in terms of what they mean, and instead of sort of formulating these ideas based on your observation of them, they have, I guess, you know, this means this type of thing.
They're more quantitative, I think, than the Jungian, the typical like psychoanalytic stuff.
That's definitely a good way.
And that's a very good thing. I'm just very curious. To wish I had a time to ask that question.
Hey,
yo, you're live. You're not gonna barf over the mic, are you?
Oh, only if you want me to.
I kind of do.
Yeah, that'd be hot. But yeah, I figured I just been kind of floating around, you know, not feeling great, but you know, it's after show. Thought I'd pop in and say that you guys had a really good interview, and that I learned a lot of stuff that I can actually use.
Very
what is this to use you speak of?
Like graphoria is just something I never really thought of before, but you know, that's quite relevant to what I do because I teach math, and so math is reputed for having a lot of worksheets, yes, and kind of dumb clerical work.
Oh God.
Yeah.
I always wondered that about mathematics, because the way I see mathematics these days is like, it's kind of like you throw some stuff on the whiteboard or chalkboard or something, and they're like, they're entities and you get to play with them. as opposed to you sit down and you just kind of grind through things on a worksheet, which is completely different. And I think you probably feel the same way about math, probably even more than I do.
Well, that's why it's more interesting in college.
Well, it's the study of guys. So it is. Because you got this guy here, and he does something with this guy, and you get this guy. That's how math is taught. And you just learn what all the different guys do.
But I mean, it's more like people have their self-efficacy just destroyed because they don't do worksheets very well, and they just have issues doing repetitive work. And it's like, well, these people could be fantastic mathematicians when they get into college, but no, I mean, they think that math is just sitting there doing dumb practice problems, like, hey, look at this example, and then just copy what it is. And they think that they're terrible at math just because they can't do that, which is just so false.
I worry, so, yeah, I guess I worry that's the case with, I don't know, a lot of people I've known over the years that just find it, that don't think they like math, and I look at them and I see, but you're so good at finding patterns and discussing how things work with each other, like, you should be awesome at math, right? Or that just seems like a natural aptitude. That's what I would induce, or induct, or what's the verb form of that?
Induce.
Inductilate,
yeah. That's gotta be right.
Well, it seems like they teach math exclusively as a theory, and it seems to me that it only when you start to give it an application, that's when it starts to be like, wow, there's so much I can do with this, and it's actually really exciting. But if you just sit there and go 1 + 1 = 2, it's just a strict memorization that bores people.
I mean, what I found interesting wasn't the practical application. In fact, I'm like horrendously bored by that. Yeah, and Eternal can attest to that. For me, it was more that recognizing that these patterns are everywhere, and the fun involved was cool taking things. Math to its extremes, like giving extreme so little math. Information. Like, here are these amazing, interesting things that you can do with it. And it's, like, for no purpose other than just expanding, like, the range of human knowledge. And because it's kind of funny and goofy and interesting.
So like, I guess that's kind of what I'm getting at in a roundabout way. I mean, if you, for example, I took differential equations. When I took it, it was just like, here's these problems.
Here's 15 ways, 15 types of diff EQs that you can actually do.
Right, and then it's sort of like, well, when I took thermo, then I had to go and derive Maxwell's equations, and I actually saw, oh, you know, this is how this can be informative to my daily life, and it's not like just that one practical application is good, it's just like that concept opened up, oh, you know, this actually does have something that, I mean, it's teaching something.
Yeah, it's also like the process, like, you know, here are these things that are lauded as being, fundamental equations, like Maxwell's equations. That's big deal. Like, Maxwell's a scientist whose name is very well recognized. And here are the tools so you can do exactly the same things that he did.
It definitely, it's somewhat empowering, actually, to be able to understand the way great minds derived things and came to their conclusions way back when. Like, I took a class in general relativity, and I went through and built from the ground up the wonderful equation for gravity and general relativity. I think it's like the Ricci tensor equals like gravitational constant times the something else. Shoot, I forgot what the equation is. Well, clearly my education worked really well, but there's this beautiful tensor equation that's really simple. It describes how everything works in the universe at the large scale, the non-quantum scale, and it just is so elegant when you see it come together.
GMM really over R squared.
You just can't really. Oh, I mean, it's way more complicated than that. What it is is the curvature of space time is proportional to, like, I think the gravimetric force in some four dimensional space. It's kind of complicated until you step back and you realize, oh, it's actually a really elegant equation that, you know, just a couple letters and a few numbers and you're there. You understand how all matter in the universe interacts, and it's beautiful.
That actually does sound really interesting. I kind of want to look into this.
Yeah.
Are we recording this?
I'll pull up the real equation in a second here when I get a chance. But the whole point is the process of going from nothing to something. That's why you don't have an appreciation until you do that. And that's what mathematics is all about. It's not about the answer. It's about getting to it from nothing, pretty much.
There are a really small number of axioms, yeah. And you can derive very, very complicated things, yeah.
and to an extent, I mean, philosophy is supposed to be the same way, which is you start, or economics, if you're, you know, into Austrian economics, which a lot of us on the show are, and a lot of our listeners probably are. So, you know, Austrian economics is the axiom of humans act. Now describe, you know, all human interaction in an economic sense. And being able to go from very, very simple premises to extremely complicated interactions, or at least very elegant interactions that describe the complexity of the world around us, that's the beauty of things. And I think
it's beautiful also. I think it's beautiful also because it's not like to come to these vast, amazing truths, you have to have this like research foundation behind you. You know, it's not like you have to be attached to some university with a lab or something. No, I mean, you can just be sitting at your computer, chilling out, listening to music, and just think of these things and imitate exactly what, you know, amazing thinkers did in the past.
Heck, you could be, what was it, Kepler literally just rode around the back of wagons going from town to town with a bunch of numbers from Tycho Brahe's research, and he just sat there and was like, I'm just going to kind of figure out how planets work. Yeah.
I hadn't heard that. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he was, I think I got the right guy, that he was the guy who was the, Kepler, the traveling dude. Or maybe, I don't know if it was him. I might be getting the wrong guy in there, but I thought it was him.
That, I don't know, you should Wikipedia that.
I should have Wikipedia that before I start talking out my ass anymore.
Yeah,
give me 2 seconds,
it's
I'm gonna Wikipedia two
it?
Things. I'm gonna Wikipedia for the audience, I'm gonna Wikipedia the Kepler thing to make sure I'm not talking out my ass, and I'm gonna Wikipedia the, equation for general relativity.
Do that. You got a task in hand right there. I did think, Anne, I made a little personal note, but per your guys' request, I thought even though she's not joining us for the after show, like our boy Stefan Kinsella did, I mean, an hour is very generous to do essentially pro bono. I mean, except for a little bit of a free promotion for their organization, but which is not to be understated.
Mutual benefit.
There we go. LDL is talking about real, honest to God volunteerism. You guys saw it here live.
I'm still looking. Still
for those
looking.
Just joining the after show, we had Anne from the Johnson O'Connor Research Foundation on for the hour. What they do there is they study human abilities, human aptitudes, essentially quantitatively measuring. That's the line kick, man. Measuring people in the interest of, you know, A, understanding human traits, and B, helping line people up for their ideal careers or at least more fulfilling ones. Seem to go well, but it almost seems like we have more questions to ask because it's such an all-encompassing and very relevant topic to people. And you know, as I was mentioning earlier, that's something that could happen. I think there was a question LDL asked that I thought was good, because having done it myself and got to think on it, there are potentially a couple of blind spots. I think LDL was asking, you know, are you guys expanding the test? Are there other aspects of personality that are being asked about? And there are things like, you know, introversion, extroversion that aren't specifically addressed. Eternal brought up there, you know, things like, you know, Jungian archetypes that, you know, are we able to get quantitative with those? Is personality stuff like that addressed? Similarly, are things like, you know, mood disorders? I mean, there's plenty of other stuff that is going to affect ultimately whether you're fulfilled, whether you are enjoying your career and life. But they don't explicitly address, which is not necessarily an overt criticism of them or you know, Anne. And again, we thank her for being on. But, you know, we're people here with a lot of ideas on declining state. And we're like, how can we make this better? What's the perfect solution? So those are things we could bring up when we talk to them later. Things that I almost wish we could have had a second hour for.
Well, I really wish, yeah, that we asked the thing that you mentioned about mood disorders, because it's sort of interesting how you can tie in some of these, I guess you could say, personalities that are somewhat, maybe you could consider considered outside the mainstream, and how they tend to affect this type of quantitative measures. It would have been a very interesting concept. Too bad.
Yeah, but I mean, there's room to grow, and in the kind of tone of entrepreneurialism and volunteerism, you know, maybe that's a new organization that could grow, or maybe that's a way that organization can advance.
It could grow like mold on orange.
Penicillin!
So, do you guys think that people become a little bit too attached to their personality archetypes anyway? Like, you're referring something I observe to me, I know when that. I hear people like Eternal talk about Myers-Briggs.
I love you guys. Yeah, I mean, I did the research into that, and I mean, I brought it up at the beginning of the cast to kind of give people a frame of reference about this is talking about, you know, how we understand ourselves. And as Anne said, that they have, and I, you know, I've talked to her before, you know, at a little bit of a length, but I didn't, you know, I didn't expect her to say as hardline as she did. You know, we're very numerical, you know, and so I, you know, goes to her as a hipster for mentioning that the Jungian stuff. I think that's one main flaw or accusation. It's a great conversation starter. I mean, there's even probably a lot of definite truth. I've heard prominent psychologists or people in the field refer to it as a, you know, guiding traits, and it's, you know, so that's that one particular is the most popular one. But one thing it lacks is studies and numbers behind it, which doesn't mean it's not true. There's not value in it, but it hasn't been, you know, rigorously supported yet either.
Yeah, well, I was referring more to what Aniran just brought up in producer chat here, that, like, you'll occasionally hear, like, on some of the Reddit subreddits that we frequent, like, you know, if you're not an NT type, you're just not going to get it. Or, you know, the people who sort of self-identify as INTJs, like, man, I'm just so introverted, so I need to stay home, and that it actually, like, influences their decision making. I'm big, strong INTJ,
don't need no friends.
It's a self-fulfilling, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, is pretty much what you're saying.
It's rationalization with the idea of, well, I am the way I am, and therefore I don't need to change or improve myself or anything, because I'm totally cool the way I am.
Well said.
Which is unhealthy, I would say.
Well said all around.
Not that, you know, knowing yourself is good. I mean, it's very, very important, but it's easy to forget that there's the corollary, which is now that you know how much you suck, you can improve on it, so you can suck less.
You have to use it kind of guidingly. I mean, the fact that they're using this towards the idea of, for example, looking towards a career and what these people tend to be happy based on these particular traits, I mean, those are things that are very relevant to people. But if you want to do something that's outside that, I don't think it should necessarily stop you, but it's probably a good indication of how your internal feelings of this will end up.
Yeah.
Yo, can I backtrack to what I was talking about with Einstein tensors?
Hell yeah.
Right, so the Einstein field equation, which is the beautiful equation that describes all of general relativity, is it's a tensor equation, so I can't really describe it well in words, but you have the Einstein tensor, which describes the curvature of space-time, equals some constant, 8 pi times, I guess it's the gravitational constant over the speed of light or something. Yeah, I think that's right. And times what is known as the stress-energy tensor, which is just some it's a mathematical construct that describes how energy works in the universe. That's the best way I can describe it.
And then my understanding is not any deeper than it was before without knowing much about tensors.
Yeah, it's hard to describe that, but the whole point is it's an equation that has two guys and a constant.
Two guys one constant.
I've seen, don't YouTube that video, please. It's got some dirty mathematics in there.
Oh, when really, we have a soundboard, that will be one thing that's on there, is the two girls one cup music that we can just hit whenever we want to, which may or may not be a good thing.
I've wisely avoided ever seeing that.
Smart man.
Oh, don't worry, I'll make you see it by accident once. Promise. I have to avoid seeing it because I haven't seen it.
Well, either, then so. My foot is accidentally going to kick you in the face.
And I'm accidentally going to drive all the way to DC and make you guys do a reaction video to it with Kermit the Frog.
Okay.
And Joe Rogan.
Got it. Yeah. So, what did I say? Oh, yeah. So the beauty of it is that, so I don't know how much you guys know about physics or cosmology, but the modern theory is that the universe is expanding, and that it's expanding at an accelerating rate. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with Einstein's greatest blunder, the cosmological constant, which he created to make a quote-unquote static universe to counteract the force of gravity. He just kind of thought it up because it sounded good, because it made the universe unchanging.
Oh, when they describe it in documentaries, they're like, you know, they have to dumb it down as much as possible. I mean, even for the people doing it, like, oh, he wasn't as cool in his later years as he was there. He said,
there goes his inductive reasoning again.
So yeah. The basic idea is, of course, the universe is full of stuff, and stuff likes to attract other stuff. So over time, stuff should attract other stuff to the point where everything collapses together into just a big ball of stuff. Makes sense, right?
Yeah, but is the and I've you know, looked into this from like reading Brian Greene books and watching a lot of documentary shows, because it's,
I like
it's
Brian Greene.
Yeah, he's amazing.
His books are really good.
Fascinating.
I own those.
You own those but haven't read them, Mr. Attack Span over
here?
Well,
no, yeah. I actually own his videos. I haven't bought the books.
The videos are definitely a lot more basic, because I have the videos too. They're way more basic than the books, which go into a considerable amount of depth, actually, for just a layman book. He does a good job of explaining it.
LDL and audience, if I was to IMHO, I would say if you're going to hit one of those books, and those books, again, are we didn't even mention them, The Elegant Universe and Fabric of the Cosmos, I would do Fabric of the Cosmos, just because the Elegant Universe topics, which is kind of string theory, I think you could kind of summarize it in one word that way, or two words.
Yeah,
he talks about that, but that's like subsumed into like two chapters of the Fabric of the Cosmos. Fabric of the Cosmos, like it sounds, is like trying to capture just everything.
Fabric of the Cosmos is the one that I have.
Good to know.
I have both. Yeah, I've read both. As I was getting to it, just to go back to what I was saying about the cosmological constant. So Einstein creates this thing called the cosmological constant, which is just literally, it's some term he just inserts into his equation to make sure that stuff doesn't actually fall together to collapse on itself. It just stays where it is.
So that would be if Brian Kaplan like added a constant to a Keynesian equation to like make it valid.
I mean, yeah, that's the idea, is that he literally just said, well, we know what the result's supposed to be, so I'm just going to kind of insert this term, and yeah, that's it. And then Hubble comes out and says, yo, guys, the universe is kind of expanding and accelerating and expanding, so yeah, that cosmological concept doesn't make a lot of sense anymore.
That has to do with the redshift of the universe and all of that deal.
Yeah,
as well,
there's some cool science behind it, but the whole idea is the universe is expanding as we know now, and it's accelerating in its expansion, as in things which are further away from us are moving faster. So you know, the things that are really, really far away from us are moving really, really fast compared to us, whereas things that are closer are moving slower.
Oh, go ahead. Going to say that if I'm remembering, and I was going to ask you to comment if this is true, as I said, I watched some of these commentaries, and the way that they give like a 2D to 3D analog conceptualization of this expansion that you're describing, if I remember correctly, is that they show like a balloon, and they say, you know, they point to two points on it, and they say that like if you blow up the balloon, that it's, I guess they said that the way these points are getting farther from themselves and like in, you know, the two-dimensional space on the surface is actually a lot farther because they're actually like in three-dimensional space, or I think
it's like blowing up a balloon when you have like, if you take a marker and you mark two points on a balloon and you measure them, you know, like with a ruler or, you know, a string and a ruler or something like that, and then you can figure out how far they are apart. Well, you blow up the balloon and they get much further apart in the absolute sense, but they didn't move on the balloon. Like, they're still on the balloon. It's that the balloon itself grew. So that's like space itself grew. So going back to the cosmological constant, it's like, you know, Einstein originally thought that, oh, there should be this cosmological constant to keep the universe static, but wait a minute, this was a really bad idea, I kind of just made it up. And then Hubble goes and he says, well, the universe is expanding and accelerating, so there's got to be something pushing the balloon bigger. So that cosmological constant term actually is used nowadays. It turns out that Einstein's biggest blunder is his greatest achievement. It's really funny how that works out.
And in which way, again, is the blunder an achievement for...
So it was a blunder because at the time, with his understanding of how the universe was, which it's supposed to be static and nothing's supposed to change, and it's supposed to be infinite and last for an infinite amount of time and stuff, so matter can't collapse on itself. So therefore, he just kind of made this term up out of thin air just because it suited the conclusion he wanted to see. Then he realized, oh, wait, this was a really bad idea because it's not mathematically sound. I just made it up. This is a blunder. I take it back, guys. It was not a good idea. And then it turns out that it was a really brilliant idea because it describes really accurately what's actually going on in the universe. But he didn't know it at the time. I see you guys are going back and forth on the chat about who to get on the show next.
And Nir and
Brian Kaplan is a name I saw on there. Exactly. Who else are you looking at?
It's been a long time coming. Him and Brett Vinod having Stefan again.
Oh, yeah.
We're spoiled here, but there's a lot of names that have been a long time coming. And Aniran, who is, you know, very much an econ nerd like myself, is thinking, oh, we got to get some good questions on for this guy. We got to give it time. And that's what I was responding to.
That you just called Brian Kaplan B-Cap. It's B-Cap. Like his street name.
B-Cap. Don't talk about the production chat toast. Yeah, I did call him B-Cap. And I did call
David Freeman D-Money. As the B-Cap.
B-Cap. I mean, Stephen Kinsella has a rap song that he was familiar with, too, that we almost outroed with. So
was really funny. Yeah.
I feel like we could get away with some of this stuff.
He knew about it, too. That was funny. Yeah, he was a fun guy to have on. I enjoyed having him on.
I mean, when you get someone to stay on, someone who's like a world-renowned IP... a patent attorney who speaks at Mises, and he's, you know, enthralled and posting on Facebook and staying on for the full 2 hours. I mean, that's a good sign, I think. those are pivotal moments.
Sometimes I wonder if some of these, like, you know, big Austrian econ figures don't have like that sort of technological out for political angst like we do. Like, there's our ANCAP and our Libertarian and other good places on the interwebs, but I don't know, like, some people probably just aren't, like, involved in that and don't have, like, imagine if Rutto didn't have Reddit to just rail on people.
Reddit now declined the state.
He probably would have exploded.
He probably would have popped. He would have destroyed South America.
Combustion.
I think there's an element to them participating in the show that they might enjoy that's just chatting with people who think similarly. Have interesting ideas.
Yeah, people like that.
In sort of maybe a non-academic way.
And you know, occasionally you'll get, like, Stefan, who just likes dancing to our intro music.
Yeah, and I mean, that's why we do the podcast, because we're going to grow besides, you know, outside, ideally, of our home nest egg community, and we can teach people to decline the state. I think, ultimately, as we go along, we can start to kind of be more surreptitious about things. We'll still steer more towards using the word voluntarism rather than, you know, things like free market and libertarian, which become loaded, and access more communities. And I think the opportunities are endless, to the point where you can see people being like, those people believe what? I like them.
So, Aniran, why don't you like voluntarism as a term? I'm curious, because I mean, I've heard critiques of it before. Is right, yeah. So property rights are not imposed voluntarily on people. Rather, yeah. That's a good critique, and I agree with it. Voluntarism itself is kind of a misnomer, which is, I think, it's not that we want everything to be voluntary, it's that we want as many things to be voluntary as possible. Which is to say, as long as you're going to have allocations of scarce resources, you're going to have property rights to help things go along. So, you know, property rights are going to make sense, and they're going to be imposed because people need to use things. So, therefore, you know, voluntary, no, but you don't really have much of a choice if you want to use stuff.
Just so I can narrate a little bit, Eternal's speaking well to Aniran in the producer chat. Aniran is one of the people that, or maybe the person who keeps us, as a decline of state, intellectually honest, very academic, very high level, so which is why we kind of take his point seriously. Aniran, do you think voluntary within the property rights, I mean, if the society agrees to respect property rights as a thing, I mean, we don't assume property rights from the start, and that becomes voluntarily established, then, you know, then does that work? Then does the voluntarism, is that whole, all of the things we describe fall under that purview?
I guess you're saying if people actually sign the social contract, so to speak?
Yeah, well, not, I guess maybe from the property rights social contract. I mean, this came out of, to be honest, it came out of a discussion with an anarcho-communist person. And I said, I kind of wanted to avoid a debate, a confrontation, because, you know, as a lot of us do as Redditors, we know where debates go. And I said, okay, I don't want to debate you whether property rights are good or bad. I just want to kind of emphasize the fact that we agree that anarchism, you know, without leaders, without owners, is good. Why not start with that and let people in the future decide what, you know, if they're property rights or not? And I didn't, you know, at least from him, I didn't get a lot of response. I mean, he didn't seem to want to deny that they could be accepted property rights.
You know, sort of the common ground between a right and left anarchist would be that whatever is right is gonna be like just emergent from people, and I sort of see volunteerism being used in place of just, you know, whatever the, you know, society happens to create. And ANCAPs think that that's going to be propertarian.
So this is relating to that book you're reading right now that you want to do a review for this show. If you want to do a sneak peek on that.
That sounds interesting, by the way.
Book.
Wait, sorry, I couldn't hear you, Eternal. You're a bit quiet.
Oh, sorry. I was like kind of leaning back in my chair a bit. Yeah, I was going to say this is related to the book that you're planning on reviewing for something for Declined Estate, the Anti-Fragility book. Did you want to do a sneak peek for anyone who's listening right now?
I've read, according to my Kindle, I've read 20% of it. So I'm not necessarily qualified to comment, but I want to. It's by the author of The Black Swan, which is sort of a bit famous. Now it's like a New York Times bestseller on statistics and events which we regard as being unlikely but still pop up more than they ought to. The author wrote a follow-up book called Anti-Fragile, which describes systems, biological, political, economic, sociological systems that have the characteristic of being sort of either robust or benefiting from disorder. So I thought, hey, like, I'm sort of a political nihilist, agnostic kind of guy. And I generally don't fear disorder. And sort of this is part of my quest of looking for reasons why I don't fear that disorder. There are a lot of systems that benefit from it. So people want to look into that. The author is Nassim Nicholas Taleb. I don't know how to pronounce that.
Taleb. Did I do it right?
Oh, man. There's a discussion going on about ostracism here, isn't there?
Yeah, whenever Niren gets in the chat, the IQ points of the producer chat that I have to follow goes up by like 60. It sucks.
Well, that's only because we're so stupid.
Yeah, I know. That's what I pointed out. And we're a little bit buzzed after the cast, but that's a different story.
I actually have drank like only half of my tiny glass of scotch here. I was too interested in what she was saying during the show, and I had too many things on the tip of my tongue. I was
that's
like,
a good
I
sign.
Be drinking. I want to chime in at any time. Yeah, I want to. So I guess I don't know if anybody's watching the listener chat right now, and there's still some listeners 45 minutes after the show actually ended. But looking for, you know, good people to bring on the show. Definitely Brett Vanat and Brian Kaplan are the top of the list. That we'll really want to get them. Who else are we just missing? Fringe elements. We need to get Fringe Elements. So three people that we just absolutely need to get on this show.
Fringlements.
Oh,
Fringlements. I would actually have to step back from the Fringlements show, I think, just for the sake of my career, maybe.
Don't be silly.
He says scary things.
Like what?
He's a bit white nationalistic.
Ah.
Okay. Like, a little bit. Like, it's not, he's big into racial hereditarianism. That is a good way to describe.
Yeah, I mean, my guess is if we had him on, we would either avoid that altogether because it would only be a source of conflict, or we would let him say his piece and then give our best rebuttal of that. But I don't think that's really worth, I don't think that's worth our time on the show to do something where we sit down, let somebody say a bunch of stuff that we're just going to go and blast them for, which is only going to, one, probably alienate some potential listeners, and two, promote a little bit of hostility on the show, and three, make our listeners a little uncomfortable while we're letting somebody.
Now, Fringe Elements has great things to say about education, though.
Oh, I agree with them on like a lot of stuff. It's just, it's one of those things where you have to walk a fine line and make sure that, you know, you just kind of avoid some issues which you know you're going to disagree on.
Yeah, those are the good points. Those are good shows. You want to prep a lot of questions, so if it starts to veer off course, you can just say, okay.
Well, actually, I think the Arini show went fairly well, though I do disagree with him on a lot of things sometimes. That one, we did butt heads a little bit, but it was really beneficial, I think.
Oh, and I wasn't referring to that one in particular. I mean, that one was good because, and I think, you know, Retta, who contacted him, you, Eternal, Toast, all mentioned specifically that, you know, there's a different way of viewing things that was kind of consistent, but with a different frame of mind, and it was fun to kind of engage and adapt, and it made for a fun conversation.
I actually think that was one of the best shows we've had. I think it was incredibly interesting, and I don't know. What did you think, Toast? You think that show was really an interesting show?
It was an interesting show. I thought it was a little strange that people tried to take him down on things like Austrian economics rather than like saying very specific probably unsupported things about women, but I do enjoy listening to him. I mean, because I agree with like about half of what he says, like kind of the political skepticism part of it. That, well, he's a guy that isn't living in the Matrix, right?
I like when I disagree. So I'm going to talk about something that might not make a lot of sense.
Inductive reasoning, like to debate people.
No. I was going to say there are people I like disagreeing with and people I don't like disagreeing with, which is to say, you know, if I listen to Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or somebody like that because I accidentally did a radio for some reason, just because I felt really masochistic, if I listen to something like that or if I'm at my parents' place and they have like Fox News or something, I don't like disagreeing with those people because I don't think they present something like I half the time I don't think they believe what they're saying for one, and the other half of the time I don't think they present anything which fosters deeper thinking in their arguments. Rather, they're very one-dimensional, flat arguments, and there's not much meat to them. Whereas
Rush Limbaugh
like
is sometimes
Reedy,
okay.
Rush Limbaugh is sometimes okay, but he also doesn't believe in half the things he says, anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that falls into the first category.
I think that's the first thing that makes you not want to engage somebody is when you get the feeling, you know, either if you do believe this, you're literally out of your mind, or you don't believe it, and that really just makes it like I can't deal with you.
Well, yeah. if they legitimately believe those things, though, that often like the more ridiculous the thing is that they believe, if they sincerely believe it, that makes it more interesting. That's why I like people like Arini who do have some wacky and unconventional beliefs,
but he's not doing anything deceptive.
They really do believe them, but they're things which are supported by they came to them from some place, which means they have some sort of rationality or narrative that they've built up to support these things. And that exploring that narrative of how they formulated that idea is so much more interesting than simply, you know, fighting somebody who regurgitates.
Insert conservative person here. You know what they believe, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, the person who talks about the conclusions versus the reasons. I mean, that's the big difference. So I like it when I talk to people, which is unfortunately extremely rare, that have really interesting narratives for how things work that I totally disagree with. Because it just makes for an interesting conversation. You get a window into their personality, a window into even like their experience as a person over their entire life. Because it all gets woven into that narrative about how the world works.
Eternal, on the same exact like train of thought, one like group of people or one like type of podcaster or guest, because we're talking about guests too, that would be I would think would be fascinating to have on to like kind of put in a room with you or you know, people that want to kind of like explore a contradictory or like a little bit altered you know, opinion or worldview, is people from the skeptical community. Some people may know the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. They are people that are very bright. They're like, you know, to some degrees less silly than us, but they're trying to kind of suss out, you know, pseudoscience and BS and, you know, point it out to people. And that's like their service to the world. And they have this like tinge of statism that's not overt, but there's this like assumption below things like, hey, you know, this is bad science. And so, and the assumption is like, the assumption always is like within a statist view, like, oh, so we need the people who, you know, support or run the government science institutions to only fund good science and not bad science. And I think it'd be so cool to see some people like go through the throat and say, hey, there's one assumption below that, even beyond you self-proclaimed skeptics, that's unchallenged. And it's that, why should the state support science? And just to see that debate play out, or that kind of discussion or argument, would be amazing.
So what you're really looking for here is to find somebody who would make a worthy debate opponent and actually host a debate on the show.
Yeah.
Like a real formal debate. I would love to do that. I think that we have a listener base that would be interested in that, a community that would be open to it. I think we could get some really good questions, and I think it would be this is a good format, it's a good group that I think we can do a fair job at hosting such a debate. And I would really love to do that, because it's something I don't... Yeah, how often do I actually get to debate people in a formal setting with a significant amount of time?
Yeah.
And somebody who I know is coming from their position with authenticity, I think...
Hey, and even not as a formal debate, as like a... I mean, it could... I mean, sometimes in a way that frames it more adversarial, even as like a complimentary, like, we have a lot of respect for you, and like towards the end or the after show like this, if it turns into kind of more of a, you know, hey, why do you believe that? Or more challenging, and not in the sense of challenging as in like difficult, but challenging as in terms of like, you know, leaning on people's worldviews and stuff.
I think a cordial debate is something which I think that is a very respectful, friendly thing. I don't think that's adversarial at all. In fact, I would say that debate is the central pillar of a civilized society. A society that can't debate things obviously is going to resort to using guns to settle the matter. The state is usually the...
I think there's something you should keep in mind, though, and that's that you're unlikely to actually convince your debate opponent in any situation of what it is that you're preaching. Now, it can make great content.
Not. Of course not. No. I would not be doing it for the sake of actually converting the person, at least at the time of the debate. I do not expect them to sit there at the end of the debate and say, okay, you win. I'm convinced.
With skeptics...
Can I plant a seed?
I hope I can like start pod beefs here because it would be fun. See, I think skeptic's one of those words that people give themselves so that they can feel good about their analytical abilities.
Dude, you should open up the fucking debate with that.
And also too, I have to admit
that'd just be brutal.
Yeah, well, I have to, it would. I have to admit that just tapping into that the quote unquote skeptic community audience as declined to state would be fucking amazing. Just like they would be like,
yeah, it's big, yeah.
It's big, and they love, you know, I mean, self-proclaimed logical reasoning skills. And like, wait a second, that can be challenged too. I mean, just to see that snowball would be really fun, even if it, you know, it starts small.
Yeah, I just see it as like one of these self-congratulatory titles that people give themselves. Like you see that a bit in when people call themselves agnostics, which is really a statement about your epistemology and what you think constitutes proof of something existing.
When people call themselves hosts of Decline the State, pretty self-congratulatory.
In the sense that we don't wear pants and we touch ourselves?
Yeah, more. I was exactly what I was thinking of.
And it's 52 minutes into the after show, so I can say that.
If we had listeners, we don't now.
It's sort of what you see in atheist cult, right? Our atheism?
Atheist cult, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's the idea that, you know, we're better than these people because some words...
Because we have a pretty high threshold for proof, yeah. And, like, for full disclosure, like, I'm actually an atheist, but...
So brave.
Yeah, I know. But the...
I was an atheist, but then I took an arrow to the knee.
But, you know, the most atheists that are on Reddit sort of have this idea that people who are religious aren't open-minded. Like, or they worse. Are, but or the best evidence that they have, which is often their feelings or their culture, points them towards believing in a god.
And yeah,
they're not just like random robots that walk around blindly believing something. It's not behavior, it's choice.
Well, it's not even just that. I would think that the people on Reddit, the atheists on Reddit, not only think that, you know, religious people are, I guess, not open and they're very close-minded, but they're actually just straight up stupid. It really is.
Like your average atheist culter on our atheism probably thinks that these, like, they don't really have any control over their actions. They're just these wandering chunks of flesh.
Yeah. And some of the, I know it's like only like 10 to 20%. And I say only kind of, you know, tongue in cheek. Like there are Redditors and Cav who are self-proclaimed Christians, or I think that's the most popular one, or religious people, who are brilliant posters, like Hexapus. I think he might even be responsible for like running the server that we're talking on right now, or maybe somebody affiliated.
I think that's right.
Yeah, I mean, that guy just says some brilliant and hilarious shit. He talks about entrepreneurialism. He's one of my favorite posters too, and I'm like, Christian. I mean,
there's some Quaker ANCAPs.
That's true.
Some call themselves deists. The fiends call themselves deists.
And Aaron's pointing out that Hexapus may be a woman. That's to my surprise, but yeah, again,
tragically, assuming that random posters on our ANCAP are male is not a bad assumption.
Yeah. I do love pointing out too, because it's like a point of pride for the diversity of the community, that Adamon 23, I don't frequent enough, is a lesbian woman, and then we have Throw Ahoy Matey, which of course is our flamboyant gay guy who contributes to the show indirectly.
Who is it that posted? We probably have more gay guys in the ANCAP community than women.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of gay posters.
I think that was Throw Ahoy Matey that said that.
He's great.
Yeah.
I like a lot of
it's all good.
The I guess atypical, not white straight male Anglican people.
Yeah, I mean, beyond just
they,
like the,
I think they have a lot to contribute to the. I mean, I would even say that those differences even factor in. Like they're almost like not. It's one of those things like you can mention them, but they're not even important.
It's not even important, except yeah, exactly. Except in the sense that you know you're talking about how could a society work and interact with like lots of people interacting, and to have a diversity of people interacting is only good for that, you know, PR point of view.
I always think of it like we don't judge each other by eye color or anything, but it's one of the things like we don't even really mention. It comes up every now and then as sort of an aesthetic thing.
I do. I hate you, brownies.
Well, I mean, some people, you know, like blue eyes for, you know, physical attraction or something, you know, or green eyes or whatever. But it's not one of those things like people just simply don't mention it. It's just not important. And that's kind of how I think a lot of ANCAPs feel about everything. All the what you would call the Marxist victim classes.
Yeah, and it's a fair approach.
That's why I mean, Marxists hate us so much.
It's a little bit, yeah, it's and I'm not accusing you of this, it's I think it's very true and generally applied. It's also, I mean, it's kind of naive to think that those rules apply to, you know, people you're trying to spread the message to, because a lot of people reduce things down to, you know, oh, you say it's for everybody, well, what about these skin colors? I mean, I don't know if it's get talked about in public school or whatever it does, but yeah, ultimately it has to kind of be blind to that kind of stuff. I think that's a good point.
Yeah, the worry is that you kind of, there are people out there who would likely be libertarians, but still see some sort of attachment to their ethnic group.
Well, I think attachment to ethnic groups aren't necessarily bad things, as long as they aren't. So there's a difference between an affinity for your ethnic group versus a superiority of your ethnic group.
Right, and undoubtedly some ethnicities are used to being privileged for it, and in modern social democracy countries, people that belong to sort of the larger minority groups tend to have those privileges. And I do fear they become accustomed to it.
Yeah, it's the victim class problem, which is, yeah, I mean, that becomes their identification as a member of that victim class rather than as a person.
Well, victim class can mean a lot of different things, though, because I think there are victim classes, people that go around, you know, particularly litigious people.
Litigious people. What? Sorry, Toast, that's you- a big. It's a big word.
You're likely to you're sue the- you.
Oh, sound it out. Litigious.
Toast. Do you think that is related to the concept you brought up before about maybe a self-limiting belief? Kind of like I think it was brought up in the context of extroversion and introversion.
You know, it's interesting. I want to point people to. I mentioned the Fiends earlier. One of the co-hosts of the Fiends, Michael W. Dean, wrote sort of the self-help book.
Fiend phone.
Yeah. He wrote this self-help book with an entire chapter on ridding oneself of victim mentality. And so he speaks a lot better than I can on that. But he thinks that people do become attached to it.
Michael W. Dean?
Mm-hmm. Yep, Michael W. Dean.
Oh, okay, yeah. I is his book available? Is it for free or is it...
yeah, it's free.
Oh, free. Oh, wow.
I actually don't really know where to get it. I host his torrent feed. So it was in there.
Okay, so I could get it off of that torrent feed. Is that mm-hmm. one place I would be able to get? Okay, yeah, I definitely could use some reading material. That would be something good to read. You recommend that book?
Yeah, I do. You know, it's just nice. Not that applicable for me in general, but it's good advice. And the guy has a really artistic and beautiful perspective on things that I can appreciate even without directly benefiting from it.
I mean, is it my big thing is it well written?
Yeah, it's conversational.
Yeah, because
it makes more sense. He has an audio version of it. He recorded an audio version of it speaking himself, and that makes more sense.
I definitely would like to hear that. Yeah, there's some people, like, their writing can be pretty good, but they write kind of the way they talk. Like, Molyneux does that, and listening to the audiobooks is just a different experience than reading it. And you actually get a better understanding of what they mean because you can pick up on vocal inflections and all that stuff. I like audiobook a lot for that reason.
Right. What MWD says is that there are people that sort of are amateur professional victims in that they often like to bring up the bad things that have happened to them previously in their life And they make it a significant part of their character, expecting privilege to come from the person they're interacting with on account of the victimhood. And Michael W. Dean calls that an initiation of force.
That's a pretty bold statement.
Yes, it is. There are a lot of those in his book. That's why I recommend it. It's interesting.
Are they actually in bold? It's like, this is a bold statement. It will appear in bold.
No.
I would write a book like that. I would
like,
actually
I doubt it, but I am listening to the audio, so I can't say for certain.
Speak in bold. Only Billy Mays can do that. Rip Billy Mays. Man, we've been going after show for an hour now, so I'm going to kill the recording and shut down the server and probably hang around a little bit longer and stuff. But
okay. Yeah, I might sign up to get food, but I mean, the energy level has been fucking fantastic. And it's, you know, for anybody who's hanging around listening to a postcast or the show, much appreciated. And it's been a lot of fun.
All right, I'm going to shut down the stream here. So
night all.
Good night, all our listeners. You good beautiful night. People, you.